It's up front and it's candid. This is Unrestricted. What's going on, everybody? This week on Unrestricted, I sit down with John Creasel. John is a retired U.S. Army veteran and a former state representative from right here in Minnesota. And John has, you're going to hear it, the most powerful and incredible, inspirational story that you're ever going to hear. 14 years ago, on the day that we recorded this podcast, on December 2nd, on that day, which he calls it his alive day, it's the day that he honors his life and the lives that were lost in an incident where his Humvee in Iraq drove over a pressure plate that ignited a bomb that went off under his vehicle. And it's an incident in which he lost his legs. He lost some friends. His life changed forever, as you can imagine. And he was able to sit down with me on his 14th anniversary of that incident and share that story with us and share how and why that changed his life forever. And you will walk away with such a tremendous respect and admiration for the way he looks at life now and how he honors his friends that he lost and how he honors his life even to this day. So this is I say this every week. I think this is, you know, the most powerful and inspirational person I've sat down with, and you will understand why I say that. So I can't say thank you enough to John for taking the time to sit down with me. So this is John Creasel, Unrestricted. All right, buddy, we're hot, and you're hot. You are looking great. That little pullover sweater with the half zip or half button. God, it's even got a button and a zip. Looks great.
I'm fancy, man. Little American Eagle going on, you know.
For the all-American man.
Yeah.
How about that? Thanks for sitting down with me. And this is – I did this last week with Marnie where you kind of date your podcast. And it's no secret that obviously this is not live. I don't do this and then push out that same day. I did timestamp last week. But I'm going to timestamp today because today is – holy smokes, this is an important day for you. So we are at Wednesday, December 2nd. And Wednesday, December 2nd for you today is your alive day. Now, when we were setting this up and texting back and forth, I wasn't putting those things together until you committed and you said, yep, we'll do it. And then I started, you know, just kind of looking at your background stuff, making sure I got all your information correct. And I'm like, oh my God. This is his alive day. Like, and then I'm like, you sure you want to do this today? Like, this is like a big day for you. And you're like, nope. As always, you're like, nope, this is great. Let's do it. So thanks for sitting down on your alive day. And now that I'm saying that, I want you to explain what alive day is and why it's important to you and why is December 2nd always and forever going to be a day that you have to honor and respect and pay tribute and consider an anniversary.
So the alive day is the day that to celebrate life, the fact that I lived through something and my buddy Tim Nelson, we lived through something that some of our friends didn't. So it's a weird day because we're celebrating life. I'm happy that I've got 14 bonus years on this earth. But on the flip side of it, two of our best friends died in a blast. And so we hit a 200-pound IED in Fallujah, Iraq on December 2nd, 2006. And I shouldn't be here. They had to shock me back to life three times. My buddies on the ground saved my life first. The first field hospital, they shocked me back to life. Tim also was severely injured. He couldn't walk. So it's a day. It's by far the worst day of my life, the worst day of Tim's life. But it's also a reminder of how lucky we are and that, I mean, we shouldn't be here. So alive, it's a weird thing to celebrate because we had friends that didn't survive, but life is so good. And I think it's a day to stop and really focus on that day and how lucky we are and focus on the good things in our life rather than the sadness surrounding that day itself.
Yeah. So to get everybody caught up, you were serving in our military in the U.S. Army in Iraq, and your armored Humvee was out on patrol. You guys went on one patrol to look for IEDs. You came back because you didn't find anything. Your mission was over. Got called back into action because of some suspicious activity. And then you guys go back out on patrol with another armored vehicle, correct?
Yeah.
And then, could you just – I've sort of set that up, but kind of take it from there about, like, what happened.
Sure. So we had been in the middle of the night. So Tim was texting me last night. He's like, it is crazy to think that 14 years ago today we left on the foot patrol because it's 8 hours ahead there. We went out, watched an intersection. IEDs had been placed at. We're hoping to find the people that were doing it so we could get rid of them.
Right.
Didn't find them. Fast forward, end up volunteering to go and check out suspicious activity. It looked so suspicious. In hindsight, we're pretty sure it was a whorehouse.
No.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah. And a couple of the single guys were joking, like, can I get a minute maybe? And we're like, no. So
how far was this from your base camp?
So we had our main base was Camp Fallujah. But we spent most of our time at two of our forward combat outposts, Pump House Flanders and Pump House Barney. So whoever named them years before must have been a Simpsons fan.
Yeah.
And what these did, these pulled water from the Euphrates River through irrigation canals so the locals could grow crops.
Oh.
So it wasn't what I pictured big open desert. It wasn't like that. And then once the water was to the pump house, it'd be pumped to Camp Fallujah. Well, the enemy knew if they cut off our water supply in the desert, we're in trouble. So we had to be at these bases often protecting it because they would attack them. But we'd run patrols from there too. So it was closer to the enemy activity. So we were at Pump House Flanders, which was about probably 4 miles maybe from, as the crow flies, maybe 2 miles.
Sure.
To where that suspicious activity. Okay. Our lieutenant saw it in a forward-looking infrared camera and said, we need people to check this out. We need 5 guys. So we raised our hand and said, we'll go. And we went down there. And that we had a Bradley fighting vehicle with us, which is a 32-ton armored vehicle. It's a small tank.
Mm-hmm.
That was the lead vehicle because the biggest danger we have is IEDs.
Yep.
And so if a vehicle hits an IED, that should be the one that can handle it more.
Yeah.
And so they were to the front. And then we searched everything. And again, it looked like a cat house.
So do they think they saw that from the surveillance just because they saw a lot of activity going mm-hmm. in and out? Is that kind of what they thought?
Yeah, it was unusual movement and activity. And I mean, I never asked Lieutenant Blomgren what he saw specifically, but he was fired up about it. Maybe he's just turned on. I don't know. So he sent us down. And of all the squads to send down there, he's lucky someone didn't get banged. I mean, that was
So how far was that into your deployment?
9 months.
So guys are just horny as hell.
Horny as hell.
Oh, yeah. God.
And especially McDonough was 21, just turned 21, just a stud athlete, played high school hockey. Just anywhere we went when it wasn't on the deployment, gals loved him. He'd pull tens all the time. He just was a fun, charismatic guy,
mm-hmm.
good looking, great soldier. So yeah, he's talking about, maybe I should go in there and spend some cash,
So let me stop you there. So you guys go to that house and you guys think it's suspicious activity. You find out it's probably a whorehouse.
Mm-hmm. That part didn't even make the book.
So we're getting an exclusive then.
Yes.
Oh yeah, we're getting real inside information here. So you guys think after you do your little raid, you think it's a cat house. Let me ask you, not from a horny 9 month on deployment rating system, what are the women like over there?
They were attractive. And
really?
They weren't, normally they cover their face and these ones did not. And I think that was part of it. And there were no guys around. Normally if the guys are around, the face are covered or the women are not around. You only talk to the men. That's a cultural thing they kind of hide them. We didn't see many women that we got to see their face. So it's kind of like 2020 for everyone. We see just the nose and the eyes. So if someone has a messed up grill, 2020 is their jam, or moving to Iraq.
So you're just going off of your imagination.
Yeah. Yeah. But these gals, I think they did show their face. These ones did though, if I remember correctly.
Yeah. But then they're like, their bodies are like in draped mm-hmm. gowns, right? So you can't even see a figure really.
Sometimes you can, though. Sometimes they're a little bit more form-fitting.
Yeah.
The older ones, no.
No.
No. Those are just big, like a a big sheet, like if yeah. you dress as a ghost.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we got that. Mm-hmm. So we get the horniness level out of the way. Yeah. Right. All right. So you guys go check that out, and then you're gonna make it back. You're just gonna be like, okay, that's it. Our mission's over. Yep. We're gonna make it back to base.
Yes. But we're walking back to, and anytime you dismount for any reason, you always leave your gunner in the vehicle to watch your back and to maintain radio contact with headquarters.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
So we're walking back, and my gunner, Marine Lance Corporal Bruce Miller, we were a mixed unit, so we had Marines with us too. He had said that headquarters had just called and said that a drone flying above us, and it wasn't like the awesome ones you picture on TV. These are like remote control, maybe a Radio Shack type deal. It's 2006, so the Spec Ops got the really good ones, but this one, you could hear it in the sky a lot of times. You'd hear like a brrr.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
They saw someone digging in the road at checkpoint 3-4, which was about 2 miles from us. We knew they weren't planting flowers.
Yes.
So we had to go check it out. So we got the same configuration. The Bradley fighting vehicle was the lead vehicle with 3 men in it. We were the second vehicle with 5 guys in it, 4 in the seats and the gunner sticking out of the top. And we headed that direction to go and roll this dude up.
And you were riding shotgun, right?
I was riding shotgun. So I was vehicle commander. So I was the one having to call in checkpoints. So okay. I was calling in checkpoint 3-1, checkpoint 3-2. And I remember calling in checkpoint 3-3. And it was like a 90-degree turn to the south. So it was, you couldn't really go straight. If you did, you'd go in a field. There was like a little trail. So you had to turn to the left. And that was the road that person had been on to dig. And so we rounded that corner. And as we rounded it, I heard this metallic, like this plink, this loud whooshing sound then after it. And then I was knocked unconscious. So but it wasn't long. I don't remember flying through the air, and I don't remember hitting the ground. But I woke up on the ground, and the rocks were still falling from the bomb blast, because these are gravel roads that we're driving on.
So when you were knocked unconscious, it was for a hot second.
Hot second.
You heard the pressure plate.
Mm-hmm.
You probably heard and felt the actual explosion, the detonation, and then you blank out.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just cut to just a few seconds later.
Right.
And the stuff is still falling on you. Okay.
Right. So it sounded like a hailstorm. It was very, it was loud. And so, yeah, it must have been, I'd say, less than 20 seconds I was probably knocked out, and I was thrown from the vehicle, because the vehicle flipped over. So if we're headed south, the vehicle flipped over completely facing north and then on its side. So it was on its side facing the wrong direction, and it was mm-hmm. That's what I woke up to looking at. I heard Tim yelling, "What's going on? What happened? Where's Brian?" And so that was I knew what had happened. You know, I joke that I didn't want to believe what had happened, but I've been a Vikings fan my whole life, so I'm used to the worst case scenario.
I love how you just tie that in there.
So, I during my speech, I started doing that, because when I started telling the story, it was tough for me to explain and tough for me to emotionally get through it.
Yeah.
So I joked about the Vikings as a way to kind of calm myself down. Now I've done it many times, and life is good now. So, but that's when I realized this is real bad. This is real bad.
Like it went from surreal, I can't believe this, to like, this is actually happening.
Yep.
This is actually happening.
And it was hearing Tim yell that really made it sink in, because nothing gets him worked up. Nothing does.
Right. Were your ears ringing? Like, is it that sort of that movie moment where things like that, and it's just like,
yep.
Is it like that going off in your head, right?
Yes. It's like a loud quiet. Is the best. So if you do a cannonball into a swimming pool, it's like that, where you hear people and it's muffled.
Yeah,
it was like that, and I didn't feel pain, but I knew I was in tough shape. Just I knew it, and I looked down. First thing, my left arm, both the ulna and the radius, were broken, so that was hanging.
Oh,
and I was real concerned about my arm, Ben. I was like, oh shit, this. I hope there's not any nerve damage. Well, I looked down and see that my femur on my left side was broken, was sticking out of my leg, wide open. So it was pretty much my pant leg is what was holding my leg on. And then my right leg, just below the knee, looked like I stuck it in a wood chipper, and I could actually hear that blood hitting the sand. So it was, I was pouring blood. So I was pretty certain that my life was going to end right there.
Yeah. So you look down, and your left femur is sticking out through your uniform, and it wasn't like chewed up like the right one?
It was, the leg wasn't, it was a picture of a baked potato with the bone sticking out. So it was open from the front.
Right.
And then the femur was sticking out. Now, below that, there were many other breaks. Okay. I've seen my medical records show that. I mean, it was, the break up top was actually the least of it. That could have, that was a pretty clean break, and they could have fixed that. It's everything below it was demolished in the nerves and whatnot. But the right one is the one that was more concerning because it was actually spraying blood.
Yeah, yeah. So then, so you're on the ground. You feel this. This is happening. This is your lot in life. Do you know where anybody else is at? Are you able to like look around? You see your vehicle that you're in. You're obviously detached from your vehicle. You hear other people, but do you see anybody else?
I think I saw Tim to my right. The vehicle was kind of towering over me. And
how far did you get thrown from your vehicle?
Probably 5 feet, okay. I'd say. Maybe not
so
even that far.
So you basically just got ejected out of your door pretty much.
Yep, I think when it was flipping that I fell out.
Okay.
But the doors, which each of the doors takes 4 Ben Liebers to lift. I mean, it's they're heavy. Maybe 2 Ben Liebers.
Yeah,
but
1.5.
They got thrown like 100 yards in each direction. So there was force outward as well. So because it blew up underneath the vehicle, opened it up like a can of peaches, and then stuff went outward.
So why didn't the vehicle in front of you get hit?
They missed it by an inch. The post-blast analysis, the report that the explosive ordnance disposal team, they said it was probably about an inch. Because you always follow the vehicle in front of you in their tire marks. But a Bradley is a tank. It's got a wider base.
Yeah.
So you pick one or the other, and then you've got two wheels exposed. We hit the 00 on the roulette wheel.
So what would have happened, not that you probably know this, but if that vehicle had hit the IED, it would have caused way less damage? Or was that because it was such a huge bomb? I think
they would have died. I think all three of them would have died because they would have been in the vehicle. And they set this bomb up to get that. When we were bringing those Bradley fighting vehicles out into the area, that's when we started turning the tide of that area, making it safer, fighting the enemy. They hated those things because it could be nighttime and they're goofing around, and we have forward-looking infrared in there.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing they're going to do. It could be a mile away and they're toast. So they wanted to get rid of those things. So it was designed for the Bradley, and I think that's why the pressure plate was set up to get hit, and then the bomb was back a little ways. They put it into 2 propane tanks, and it was 200 pounds of explosives. So I think it would have got the turret. I think Adam and Todd would have been dead. And there wouldn't have been a way to be ejected from the vehicle.
Right.
And everybody that lived in our vehicle was ejected.
So that energy actually, the lightness, quote unquote, the lightness of your vehicle, the fact, kind of like an Indy car, the fact that it was able to break up and use that energy to get you guys out of that critical space is probably what saved you.
I believe so.
Yep. So if they were inside the tank, the armor from the top and whatever, that would have kept them in that little pressure. And they did, yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Wow, that's fascinating to think about. So you're there on the ground. You know that both of your legs are not good. The guys from the Bradley obviously stop. They're the ones that help out first.
Correct.
And they provide all the tourniquets and all that stuff, and they radio in the helicopter to get you guys out of there.
Right. Immediately.
And how much time elapses there between them radioing in and then the medic getting to you guys to get you out of there?
I think it was within 18 minutes. I'd heard 11 minutes. I've heard 18 minutes. And so the guys that one of them said 11 minutes, the other one said 18. So split the difference, 15 minutes. And it seemed like forever. Right. I mean, you're sitting there and you feel just so alone because you're in the middle of nowhere. And you're surrounded again by farm fields and whatnot.
And this is what time of day?
3:45-ish. I think the call went in about that time. It was just before 4 o'clock.
Morning.
P.M.
P.M.
Yep,
okay.
Because we did that morning mission.
Because you did the morning mission at like 2 a.m. or something, right?
Yep. And then I think we left at 3. We ended up, no one showed up, and we got spotted. So we had to go back to the pump house. And we were just chilling, taking a nap. And that's when he spotted the suspicious activity and needed the volunteers. So, yeah, it was in the afternoon. It had been a long day.
Yeah, that's a long day. Mm-hmm. So then you're on there, and then you said you lose consciousness.
I stayed awake until the helicopter.
Yes.
I started losing consciousness because I heard to my left, I heard someone gurgling. Mm-hmm. I heard awful sounds that I will never forget. And so I knew I wasn't the most severely injured. And I had to think, and it's weird, you have like 5 years of thoughts in this short amount of time. Everything does slow down. And I was thinking, and I had already been through EMT training and stuff because I wanted to be a firefighter, paramedic firefighter here in St. Paul. I thought, if I survive this, I don't want to live with seeing one of my best friends, one of the men I was in charge of, dead or fighting for his life. On top of that, I need to stay calm because I've lost a ton of blood.
Right.
And I need to keep my heart rate down. And seeing that wouldn't do it. So I kept closing my eyes to chill out. Horrible idea. And those guys are running around triaging everybody. There's two guys really working on the five of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd reach down, and I don't know whether it was Adam or Todd, but they'd slap the shit out of me. They'd slap me in the face hard. And they're like, stay awake. And then again, stay awake. And like the third one, I'm pretty sure was a punch.
Really?
So they're like, damn it, I said stay awake. And I'm like, I lived through this bomb and my friends are going to beat me to death. What the hell? So, but they needed to keep me alert.
Right. And do you even remember, because I'm sure your pain sensors in your body's in such shock, do you even feel those punches and slaps?
Like, oh, yeah. Those like, I did.
You did?
Yeah.
So
I didn't
that
feel
was like
my
a real,
legs, though. My,
okay.
Well, I didn't feel the pain in my legs at that point. It was kind of like the human body's amazing. The stuff that it does, it's like the body goes, holy shit,
and
we need to keep you calm,
that.
And it shuts down.
So you said that keeping your eyes closed and not doing that stuff was a bad decision. Why was that a bad decision?
Because I started dreaming. So I was like falling asleep. And that's when you're going to slip away.
Oh, I see.
And I had already lost a ton of blood. And so they need you awake. They need you talking. Even if they're doing something else. How's it going over there? And they eventually realize, well, they came back. And Adam, the first guy that came up to me, my buddy Adam Gallant from way up north, Plummer, Minnesota. He's not able to sugarcoat anything. That's his thing. He just wasn't born with that talent. So he comes up to me and he looks at me.
So
he
no
says,
filter.
No filter. Yeah. You stole his podcast name.
Right? Yeah, right.
So, and he comes up and said, I'm not going to lie to you. Your legs are really bad, okay? And I'm like, no shit. I'm staring at my bones.
Right.
But he's telling it like it is, but he's like, we're going to get you out of here, okay? Said, all right, cool. And he put the tourniquet on my right leg, tightened that, got that bleeding to stop because that was the one that was going to kill me.
Mm-hmm.
He had to check on the others. Todd comes up next, and Todd now lives in Oakdale. Todd's the total opposite. You've met Todd before. He comes over and says, hey, buddy, you look great. He's smiling. He's like, you'd think we're out at happy hour.
Yeah.
He's like, we're going to get you out of here. You're going to be home soon. You're going to see your family. You look awesome. Like, it was the fakest smile I'd seen until I got into politics. And he just, but that was good. It cheered me up. And he put a tourniquet on my left leg. And that one took more work because it was kind of a mess.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was a mess, it wasn't bleeding a ton.
Okay.
So then they got that squared away. Adam comes back over and said, we're going to have to move you. This is going to suck real bad. Because the vehicle's on its side, and it's the noise I heard from my friend fighting for his life, the vehicle was lying on him.
Oh.
And so they needed to get it off of him, but they're debating on whether the vehicle's what's keeping him alive.
Correct, yeah.
And so in all of this, we go through combat lifesaver training.
But they're not medics.
But they're not a doctor. And,
yeah.
And so, yeah, it's the debate. And they're going to have to live with that decision the rest of their life. And so, in hindsight, I don't think that was what was keeping them alive. But the vehicle was unstable, so they had to move me. So they lifted me up. They flipped my legs up onto my chest.
Oh.
Yeah, and that was the holy shit moment. And I felt pain because my pelvis had been broken. So both wings of my pelvis, the iliac wings, were moving up and down. My sacrum was shattered. So that was the pain. So I let out a yowl. Let them know I felt that so they didn't hit me anymore.
Yeah.
And they moved me away from the vehicle to a safe spot. And then they had the person you would have thought was the most severely injured was our gunner. And he, but he got launched out of there like a Roman candle, and he was like a buck 40 soaking wet.
So he just flew out of
there. Flew out of there. Yeah, like Super Dave out of the cannon. And he's just, he wouldn't shut up. He's like, what time is it? You guys, what time is it? What? His watch had been blown off. And I'm to this day, I'm like, I'm pretty sure he didn't want to miss dinner chow, because this was going to be one of the first hot meals we had in a while. So he's like, this bomb isn't going to get in the way of me and getting a fucking hot meal. So he's running, just repeating himself. So he obviously had a brain injury, but I'm very sure he started the deployment with one.
Yeah.
This goofy kid. And yeah. So they told him, sit down, keep Creasel talking. Perfect. So he was asking me simple shit that he knew, because we knew each other for 9 months. He's like, where do you live? Cottage Grove, Minnesota. What's your favorite team? Minnesota Vikings. And he's like, let him die, he'll be better off. No. And then he's like, what's your favorite color? Blue. All right, Roger, Roger.
So what were his injuries?
Head injury. And he had cuts, because he came back home. They sent him out of country. He had some open wound, but his head injury was bad enough that they shut him down for the deployment.
Yeah.
Okay. So he just, but he could do that job though. He could over and over just keep me talking.
So so limbs wise, all that stuff.
Yep.
He had no internal injuries. It was all,
which is nuts. He's sticking out of the top.
I know.
Of the
that's
vehicle
what I'm trying to figure out. Because he got launched, and so he hit the ground hard. So he must have just hit it right on his head.
Yeah, had to have. And there's a big shield around you. Part of the shield was gone. I mean, it was a massive bomb, but it just worked. It's chance. I mean, Tim in the seat behind me didn't lose any limbs. He's got back injuries. He's got other injuries. He's got head injury. But yeah, they kept. In reading the sworn statement afterwards, it's funny that I think it was Todd's that said when he heard me telling Miller to shut the fuck up, he knew Miller was doing his job keeping me awake. He was pissing me off because I'm like, enough.
Yeah.
And then I felt myself get cold and I was like, yeah, this is it.
And that cold sensation, because I'd heard you tell this story before, the cold sensation, is it really one of those full body cold sensations, or is it something that like you feel like in your spine or like the back of your neck, or is it really like your
full body,
like you're outside in the winter here in Minnesota?
Yep.
Like cold.
And it was like gradual. It was starting to come on, and I'm like come on, no. So I'm hoping, I mean, I prayed my butt off trying to make it through this, and then I'm like, you just kind of, it's a helpless feeling because it feels like it's just death is now grabbing you.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm 25 years old. I'm like, this is where it's going to end. Just this chaotic situation in the middle of the desert. And I grabbed Adam with my good arm and I said, tell my family I love them.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, he said, shut up, you're going to tell them yourself. And I was like, all right. I hoped he was right, but that is
right.
That gave me hope. And that's when I was like, I can survive. I have to. This is it.
So I find that fascinating because we've all seen war movies, and this is sounding like it's just right out of a Hollywood script, right? Even down to the verbiage, like shut up, you're going to tell them yourself. Like mm-hmm. all these things, like we've all kind of seen this on the screen, but you're living it, you actually believed him. Like that, those words seem so cliche,
mm-hmm.
you know. And in that moment, you actually felt like a little bit of hope. Just from those few words of like, no, you'll tell them yourself. And
I did.
And you're like, oh, maybe I will.
You can see the look on their face, and knowing them, they believed it. And even to this day, he said he knew that I was going to survive, which is crazy considering my injuries and the fact that I still had to be shocked back to life 3 times at the hospital. But yeah, he looked at me and said, and I didn't hear this part, but other guys did, where Todd, when they were loading me into the helicopter, Todd said, he's going to live. You're saving him. He's going to live.
Mm-hmm.
And so Todd, I don't think, was as certain as Adam was that I was going to make it, but they had no room for error. And you go through the combat lifesaver training, and you're putting tourniquets on mannequins, and it's crazy that they had to do it for real, and they didn't mess up one bit, or I wouldn't be here.
Right. I mean, which is such a testament to the training that you guys have to mm-hmm. go through, and really a short amount of time. I mean, yeah. when you guys go through basic, and you guys go through that stuff, it seems like many, many months, but when you pack in all the things that they're training you to do, not just the protocols and how to, you know, raid a house and how you go through your military life, but then when it comes to life-saving measures, it's been repped and trained so much that when it actually happens, like, those guys didn't skip a beat.
Right. They don't have time to think. Similar to, you know, to your football career, right? you go over the stuff over and over.
Yeah.
And you do the, and I, that's why there was one time I got to go and watch Walkthrough. I think it was 07. You guys still had Childress. Yeah, it was Adrian's rookie year before he went and played Denver. Got to watch the Walkthrough. And, you know, there was another family there too, and they're watching, and I think someone had been like, oh, they're just kind of walking through. I think one of the kids, because kids will say whatever.
Right.
But the Walkthrough is so important because it's, you're not doing it at full speed, but you, everyone knows where to be. That's important. And we do that in the military too. There will be, we'll draw a big square in the sand and practice raids that way. And you'll have, okay, there's a house here, draw a big square, house there. And you practice it enough that it's on a much smaller scale. And those were just squares in the dirt, but you know where everybody is.
Right.
And you don't have to think too much about it because you got other shit to worry about. So that's where it's very similar, is you do it enough that you don't have to think too much.
Which can be super mundane.
Mm-hmm.
Very mundane. And we talk about all the time, if even if you're not in it and you're like a number two or number three, you know, we talk about the mental reps. Like, okay, you're not actually in it, but you have to pay attention because if you get in, we expect, we have the same expectations for you when you get in there. And I'm sure that's the same thing with the military. Like, you might not be on that raid or that mission, but you better pay attention because there's going to be a time where it's going to be your call.
Yep.
And your time to go out there. So you've got to mentally rep that probably even as you just lay in bed.
You do. Yep. And I mean, what if the team leader gets shot? He's down, and you get him out of there, but now next man up. And then that E4, that 19-year-old kid, is now in charge. He better know what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of it, though, is you got these kids that they're in charge of so much. I mean, this millions of dollars of equipment, but they're more responsible for each other's lives, too.
Yeah.
And that's really the reason you're there, is people can debate about the reason that we went to war and whatnot. But we're there for each other, and that day showed it, because these guys, they would not let me die, and I'm so thankful for it.
So you get loaded up onto the helicopter, which, and you said that it felt like forever laying there, and it may have been 15 minutes, and you felt your body in death's grip sort of just grabbing you and squeezing you. And then you lose consciousness, and you said you wake up, what, 8 days later in the hospital?
Yeah, Walter Reed.
So what does that 8 days feel like? Does it feel like when you wake up out of anesthesia and it's just kind of like a snap of a fingers?
Yep.
Or does it seem like a journey?
It was like there were some dreams in it, and there's times. So I thought for a long time that I didn't remember any of the spots that I was at. Alta Kadem Air Base is the first field hospital they took me to. That's basically a level one trauma center. And I'd never been in there before, so I don't know what it looked like. But I had pictures of it in my mind. Of like, I remember people saying, John, just saying my first name over and over and being brought in. But with all the medication and stuff, who knows what's real and what isn't? Well, I looked, and it might have been when we're doing research for the book. I was looking through photos of Alta Kadem Surgical Hospital, and I remember that inside. I'm like, I've seen that before. And I'd never been there before. So
your
eyes
were probably open, processing information. But your brain is not making the connection that you're awake.
Mm-hmm. Whatever they gave me on that helicopter, because they asked me my social security number, and the first number of it, I couldn't even get out, and then I was out. So what it is, they give you something on the helicopter. Everyone gets something that kind of disables them so they couldn't freak out and bring the bird down. But also, on top of that, they're, I'm sure, giving me other stuff to prep me for. They brought me right in immediately, and my company commander was there as I was brought in, and basically said that my leg like fell and he had to pick it up and like put it on me. And then they got me settled in, and or not settled in, but they had to shock me back to life then three times as they're doing surgery. And it just so happened that there was a training going on that day at that hospital. And so there were doctors from all around.
No
Otherwise,
way.
There wasn't enough people to deal with everything. There was, I think it was three or five surgeons working on me at once, because I had my vest had opened up, I had lost part of my intestines. There was a lot going on, and so it just, as far as luck, I can't complain about luck the rest of my life, whether I lose on a bet or in
yeah,
Vegas.
Right.
I used all my luck that day.
Well, I hate to interrupt such a great conversation, but I have to thank my sponsors. I couldn't do this without my sponsors, so I want to thank Douglas & Todd Small Batch Bourbon. Everything about Douglas & Todd is all Minnesota. The wheat, the corn is all grown within 30 miles of the distillery up in Osakis. It is distilled there. It's bottled in Princeton, Minnesota, and distributed around the country. It is bourbon season, people. The weather's getting cold, and I can't think of a better thing on a cool night. Nice little glass of bourbon. So Douglas & Todd Small Batch Bourbon, please enjoy responsibly. 21 plus bourbon whiskey. It is 46.5% alcohol by volume. It is produced and bottled by Ed Phillips & Sons Company in Princeton, Minnesota. Thank you. Also, Pick & Shovelware. Head over to pickandshovelware.com. Check out all their awesome shirts and hats and hoodies. Again, it's getting a little cooler. I love a good hoodie, and they make awesome hoodies and apparel that are specific to Minnesota. They have all these fun graphic designs of your favorite sports teams, favorite sports moments as well. So very sports-centric, Minnesota sports-centric apparel company. You can get 20% off your first order at Pick and Shovelware if you just use the promo code LIEBER. That's L-E-B-E-R, 20% off your first order. And also to Wexford Harbor Insurance. They're an independent insurance agent representing over 40 different companies. The man, the guy that runs Wexford Harbor, Pat Kelly, look him up. He and his staff are sure to take care of you. They're going to find the best value for you, for your family, for your home, for all of your auto needs, anything that you're looking for, umbrella insurance, or if you're in the commercial space looking for commercial insurance as well. Over 40 different companies that he independently checks for you. That's Wexford-Harbor. That's harbour.com/unrestricted to find them. Wexford-Harbor.com/unrestricted or email them at info@wexford-harbor.com. All right, let's get back to the show.
So the amount of circumstances that happened for you really are quite astonishing, you know, because if you get there, all those things happen, you get ejected, which was probably a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, thankfully you have trained soldiers around you to take care of you. You're not that far away from the helicopter. So 15 minutes maybe it felt like a long time, but Right. Really in the grand scheme of things saved your life, and the fact that it happened only not far away from where the helicopter was. And then they were doing doctor training at that same trauma center.
Mm-hmm.
Because if not, how many doctors would normally be there? Do you even know that?
I don't know. I mean, probably not a lot for, I mean, if there's a big vehicle-borne IED that goes off in a village, they obviously at this hospital, they'll deal with Iraqi civilians as well. But then they'd have to call in doctors from around to try and get them there to help out because there's too many people that need help. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm very thankful. It just worked out.
So let's go back to your kind of dreamlike state. Outside of being kind of putting the memories and the images together that you're at that trauma center, then you get moved to how many other hospitals before you actually wake up?
So first one, Al-Takadim in Iraq, which is near Habaneh, then Balad, which is north of Baghdad, then Landstuhl in Germany. And Landstuhl is where things were wrapping up. They family flew over basically to say goodbye. I missed 3 flights home because I wasn't stable. My situation deteriorated. And they told my family, nobody misses 4 and survives. And So I made that 4th one. So then Walter Reed was where I woke up in the U.S.
So all of that happened. So your family came over to Germany,
mm-hmm.
and you weren't awake for that.
Mm-mm. I was not.
So, again, at those little mental checkpoints, do you remember anything else?
I don't. It was there might have been one time that I was, like, starting to wake up, and someone was over me being like, it's okay, but that's it. Then it was the U.S. at Walter Reed.
All right, so then how do you even begin to start putting the last 8 days in the life-altering, instantaneous situation? How do you comprehend that when you wake up? Like, who is there to help you put those pieces together?
So my ex-wife was, and then the nurse. And when I woke up, it was, I think they were taking me off of the medication, the medically induced, because it was a medically induced coma.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember looking around, I saw that my legs had been amputated.
Mm-hmm.
I had a C-collar on, I had casts on my arms, I had a wound vacuum on my stomach, because I didn't know that I had taken shrapnel to my intestines. And so my hope that this had all been a dream was clearly not the case. So I asked immediately, where's Tim?
Mm-hmm.
Where's Nellie? And everything came rushing back, the sound of the blast, the smell of the gunpowder. And I've still had some of that on me. I wasn't very cleaned up because mm-hmm. they're focused on the bigger picture.
Yeah, saving your life.
And I was told that Tim was still in Iraq. He got banged up badly, but he was going to be back to work in a couple weeks. That's what a badass he is. Yeah, I think he injured the bomb. And so I then, because obviously Tim's my best friend to this day still. But I asked, what about the others? Mm-hmm. And really the look on the face was just, I knew. Mm-hmm. And I was told that Corey and Brian had died. And so that, for me, that was rock bottom. Mm-hmm. I felt we had just been on a patrol that we volunteered for, on a deployment we volunteered for. You have all these plans. We're going to raise our families together. We're going to do this. And all of a sudden, they're like, I'm sorry, they're dead. There's no, that rock bottom in my whole life was hearing that. But it also, when I felt that, it motivated me to be like, I'm getting out of this room. I better not feel sorry for myself because I'm still alive. Mm-hmm. They didn't know if I was going to walk again or whatnot. None of that mattered. I got to be alive. And I was like, that's it. I'm gonna make the best out of this moving forward. So it was.
But how quickly can you come to that conclusion? You know, how quickly can you go through those emotions of, I've lost two of my best friends. You did not get to say goodbye to them properly.
No.
You look down at your own legs and your life, and you're like, I'll never be able to walk again.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have this realization that I'm obviously very lucky. I cannot waste another day feeling sorry for myself. How do you go through that cycle of emotions, and how long did it take you to do that?
I mean, it was that day is when I really, of course, it's sounds easier to just be like, yep, I said I'm going to be fine, and then I was. But it's obviously not like that. It was more, I'll say I'm thankful that I stayed conscious for the time that after the blast, for the mm-hmm. majority of it, because if I just woke up at Walter Reed and was like, what the hell's going on? Where are my legs? What's going on? And then they're like, oh, and by the way, two of your friends died. I'd be like, oh, my God.
Right.
Whereas I thought I was going to die. Mm-hmm. I was pretty sure of it. And so waking up at Walter Reed was like, oh, my God, I am alive.
True.
And so there was that. Obviously, reality continued to set in to the point that even that was during the, do you remember every 5 minutes, especially during football, was the Army Strong commercials.
Yeah.
I didn't want to watch those. I was like, turn the TV off, because it was just a reminder. I was just doing that job and now I can't.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a doctor there right away that said, I need you. He came in, and I remember, and we're friends on Facebook, Dr. Cooley, great guy. But I just remember staring at his, he had an Ohio State pin.
Yeah.
And I was like, you son of a bitch. He said, please tell me everything you remember from the blast. I couldn't even get a sentence out, and I'd be sobbing.
Right.
Because I just found out my friends died, and now this guy wants me to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, no way. But I'm in a hospital bed with no legs. I'm not running away from this guy. And so he's like, take your time. It's fine. Made me talk about it more. Kept it up until I got through the whole thing. And then, all right, let's do it again. And that, I think, is what set the tone for now moving forward. It put things in perspective, getting it off my chest, but also then realizing as you verbalize it, you go, holy shit, I am so lucky.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's to this day, I'll never be over the loss of those two guys. They were such wonderful dudes. And if I got over it, there'd be something wrong with me. Like that pain is a good reminder, because they were so awesome. And it's a reminder of really how lucky I am, how lucky Tim is, and how Bruce as well.
Yeah, I have to imagine, you made a good point that if the blast happens, and let's say the only thing you remember is the clink sound, and then next thing you know, 8 days later, you're in Walter Reed. that's a really hard realization that, like, wait a minute, no, I was just sitting there. Like, mm-hmm. why am I here and why do I have half of my body left? But that 15 minutes of laying on the ground and analyzing and coming to grips with your reality, I never thought about how that would be so impactful going forward of, like, of you coping with it. Because you know, like, no, this is reality. Because I remember laying there and I remember hearing all the sounds and looking down and everything that happened. Like, you can't lie to yourself at that point in time.
Nope. I mean, it was very clear. And it was where everything hadn't been stitched up yet either. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are certain things that were, but all the dirt and yuck that goes in there, that has to kind of work its way out. So, I mean, it was clear that my legs were gone and they weren't coming back. And so that I am thankful for that 15 minutes. And again, it's one of the worst 15 minutes of my life. But one of my friends who's been through a similar incident in Afghanistan, Jack Zimmerman, he's double above the knee amputee. He stepped on a bomb. Oh. He talked about how he was awake for his and his life flashed before his eyes. Similar, like, I thought about Little League baseball playing it, and I wasn't great at it. My nickname was Johnny Walker because I drew so many walks. I wasn't a power hitter, nothing like that. I thought about my mom getting the phone call and dropping it. I didn't think about my ex-wife getting the phone call. I thought about my mom getting it. The weird things that you choose to think about and all that at that time. But Jack articulates it perfectly. He said, as his life was flashing before his eyes, now he's thankful to be alive, that at the end of his life, when his life flashes before his eyes again, he said he wants to make sure that it's worth watching. Mm-hmm. And I think that is so profound because that's really what it's about. My life there at 25, I thought it was over. And I thought, I've got so much more to give. I've got so much more life to live, experiences to go through. And this is it. I mean, it's horrifying to think through that. And you do it in a calm way. Your body just makes mm-hmm. everything calm. But then waking up at the hospital, I thought, okay, now it's game on.
Yeah.
And they said, you might not walk again. We got to piece your pelvis back together. And I'm like, all right, challenge accepted.
Right. So what I find really interesting is the conscious and the subconscious. So let me ask you this. When you talk about Little League baseball, being nicknamed Johnny Walker, picturing your mom getting the phone call, the dreaded phone call, have those things always been that important to you consciously? Like, were you a mama's boy? And, like, did you really love baseball as much as you think maybe you thought you did? Like, those priorities in our brain versus maybe the reality, is all of that true? You know, was all of that accurate? Like, did you ever question, like, well, why the hell am I thinking about baseball right now?
Right.
But did you always love Little League baseball? Like, is that one of your childhood cherished memories?
It must be. I never thought of it.
So you never really thought of it like that? So you weren't, like, gung-ho, like, when it was Little League baseball season, you weren't like, fuck yeah, I get to go to practice. And, like,
right.
like you weren't that kid growing up. But you must have obviously, like, somehow put that in your storage that this is a big part of my life.
Right.
Even as a kid.
Yeah.
I find that so fascinating. It's, like,
isn't it weird? The mind is just... And my mom getting a call, if I died, she wasn't getting a phone call, they would have showed up at the house. They do that notification in person. So even my mind was wrong in that sense. So, but I ended up being right because she did get a phone call. She Gronk spiked the phone. and so yeah, I do cherish the Little League memories. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize I cherished them that much, but it's weird the stuff you think about.
Yeah. Anything else that kind of came through your mind in those moments? Those are the two biggest things.
But. It was mainly that. I think I thought about basic training for a minute. But it was, because you got 15 minutes of thinking. Mm-hmm. And now when Miller started talking to me and making me repeat myself.
Yeah, then he was distracting you because you're telling him to shut the fuck up.
Right, exactly. Miller, enough.
I'm reliving this Little League dream here, all right? Just relax.
I just fucking legged out a single, which is never going to happen again. So let me be.
and this is the best part about you. And I know a lot of people listening to this have heard you on the Power Trip Morning Show. And hopefully there's a lot of people that are new to hearing this story and new to you. Ever since I've known you, and I've only known you, you know, post this situation, you really are, like, you approach this with just such a positive way. I mean, the guys will rip on you about the radio, about, you know, calling you Lieutenant Dan, you know, or they'll make a joke even when you're not in the studio about, you know, well, Creasel couldn't do that because he's got no legs.
Right.
Like, and you just laugh with the smile that you have on now. I mean, it is amazing that you have that perspective and that you joke about it yourself. I mean, how many other guys, and I'm sure that you've been through other support groups and things like of that nature, I've talked to other guys that have been injured. I'm going to guess that's probably pretty rare that guys have this funny, almost like whimsical outlook on their situation.
Mine might be a little more extreme than most, but I will say the vast majority of the people I was at Walter Reed with, same deal. Jokes all the time, making fun of one another. Ward 57 is the amputee ward. And so all of your neighbors are missing limbs. That's where if you're not on there, if you have all your parts. And so at physical therapy, the guy to your right, you're motivating them. If they're starting to slow down a little bit, and they might be missing one leg below the knee, we'd be like, hey, rug burn, paper cut, let's get to work. You motivate each other, you make fun of each other, and it's a coping mechanism.
But do you think that they do that out in their regular life? Because I know the fraternity and I know the safeness, and it is a locker room mentality, and you feel safe and you feel comfortable to do that because you know the guys in the other room, they're dealing with very similar things, if not something different or worse or whatever. Do you think that they're like that in their regular lives, though? Do you think those same guys go back into their normal lives and they're able to joke around about the same way that you guys joked around in Ward 57?
Most of them, the ones that I know now that I'm close with, that I have interactions with, yes.
Yeah.
Like Jack Zimmerman jokes around, and he doesn't wear prosthetics. He cruises around on a Segway wheelchair and is just the funniest guy. He's always making fun. He changed his driver's license height to be what it is now.
No way.
Yeah. And he's like, he showed me, we're at an event in Memphis for wounded veterans, and he was like, hey, look at my driver's license. And it was like 3'8" or something. and he's just got this big smile. They're coming around serving hors d'oeuvres. He's like, no, I'm good. I got to drive. Which it's an hors d'oeuvre. And they look at him like, there's no alcohol in this hors d'oeuvre. But he's just funny. And it's, I think in the military, it sets that for you. You learn at basic training. Drill sergeants are some of the funniest people ever. They make fun of you. They make fun of everyone around. You make fun of your buddies, similar to a locker room.
Mm-hmm.
And then when something like this happens, you learn to laugh about it and you move on. And it's, I have this reality every day. I wake up, I get in the shower, I put my legs on, I put my pants on my legs, and I put my underwear on my legs, and then I put my legs on.
So okay,
you don't do it that way, Ben.
Go through that again. You put your pants on your prosthetic legs.
Yep.
And then you put your underwear where?
On the prosthetic legs over it, unless it's the pants from the day before. I just keep them down at the ankles.
Which tends to happen.
I put the underwear over the top, and then I climb in my legs and put them on.
So then, how do you shower?
I wheelchair into. I have a roll-in shower. My house is fully handicap accessible. Wheel into the shower. I have a shower chair. Hop in there. So I'm glad I got my arms.
Yeah.
And hop on in there. Shower. And when I'm done, I wheel out, dry off, put my legs on. That's how I start my day.
So you're fully 100% capable of doing everything on your own.
Mm-hmm. I am.
So you're.
Thank goodness.
So your wife doesn't have to get up to help you do anything. Like if in the middle of the night you have to go pee, you can just wheel yourself to the bathroom.
Yep. I hop in my wheelchair, and there's the little at the bottom where there's a footrest for people.
Yeah.
Mine folds up because I don't need it. And I just wheel it right up to the toilet, hop on. So I face the reservoir of the toilet.
Oh.
Or the tank.
The tank.
Yep. So that's where at night, yeah. I mean, if it's a big job, I'm going to spin around. Trust me. But if it's just a number one, yes, I'm going to basically.
So you kind of sit on the toilet like you're hugging it.
Yeah. Yep. That's what I do. It's a great visual, isn't it?
It's a great visual.
Just this legless man just hugging the shitter.
That is awesome.
Yeah.
That is great.
I'm very lucky. I mean, really, if there's stuff on like a high shelf, yeah, I'll have her get it because she can use her tippy toes. But that's, yeah, I mean, it's It's I've adjusted, and now at Walter Reed they get you ready for that. They have a fake apartment that it's not Mike's.
Well,
it's not Mike's apartment.com or anything. But you go in there, and before you get to go home on your R&R, you got to show that you can get in and out of bed. You can hop on the toilet. You can use the cabinets.
What an amazing facility.
Yeah. And it's crazy because it's shut down now. It's gone. They moved. They consolidated to this big campus in Bethesda.
Uh-huh.
And so now, like, looking at photos, someone went through there and it's just gone. Now I believe it's leveled. They're building apartments there.
So the hospital that you were at is gone. They've just kind of upgraded and they're in a bigger facility now.
But
which I guess is good because they're probably offering more services.
Way more.
Yeah.
But it's – so that it's – I've adjusted, but that reminder every day, there's – that's why I joke about it, because this is my reality, and I could sit here for the rest of my life and I could look back on December 2nd, 2006, wish that it never happened, wish my friends were still here, wish I still had legs. That's going to do nothing. Right. I have no control of that, but I can control my attitude today. It's up to me to make today great.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what it's a choice.
Right.
And that's what I try to do every day.
Does your life in any way, because I'm sure you've gotten so proficient and efficient at it, that do you have to allow extra time in the morning, maybe that you didn't before? I mean, maybe not exponentially, but like maybe 5 minutes,
yep,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So your life has probably changed after all the training and getting used to your prosthetics and walking around, 5 minutes here and there of added extra time.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
Because obviously we've known each other for a while, and you know, you walked right into this studio, and obviously you can tell that you've got a gait to you that's different, but you don't walk much slower than most people. You know, you're not just shuffling around. You know, it doesn't seem like you have, you know, your wife has to wait on you. Like, hurry your ass up, slow
park. I mean, once in a while, I might say, go into the pantry and grab me some Douglas and Todd.
Yes.
And that's
which you've got in front of you. You can crack that open right now.
I will. It's life is just so good. And so I'm not, obviously, I wish it didn't happen, but I'm very thankful for the lessons I've learned. And it makes me, like this morning, you know, when I post that every December 2nd, I post a thread walking people through that day. And it's not for look at me, none of it.
No.
I want to teach people the things I've learned without them having to go through it. And I want to honor Corey and Brian. And now, since having Chloe, in my first marriage, I had two stepkids, and it was fun raising them. Now with little Chloe, I've been there since I watched her be born.
Yeah.
And it really... as I'd be lying if I said that I didn't wonder every day why I'm alive and why Corey and Brian are not.
Mm-hmm.
It's not fair.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing that little girl, I think that's the reason it has to be. And this morning she gave me a hug and a kiss, and I'm like, life is good. I mean, no matter what happens, no matter my injuries and how different life is now, it puts everything in perspective.
Yeah. And I think that I think everybody knows that where you come from is genuine. You know, I think, you know, every December 2nd, you keep posting that thread. I don't think anybody looks at that as like, hey, look at this narcissistic guy that's just about himself. No, you're doing it the right way. You're honoring the people in the right way and why this day is so important to you. How much do you miss the military?
A lot.
Yeah.
I do. It was
You were in for how long before
10 years. 10 years, and I joined the Minnesota National Guard, and it was on my 17th birthday. I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I saw the first Gulf War on TV, I said, I want that job. And so I joined the Guard because you could join that right away, go to basic training before senior year in high school. And I came back, so I wasn't as much of a smart ass after those drill sergeants put the boots to my ass. Like and I needed it. I had a great upbringing. But I had very little parental guidance. My parents both had horrible upbringings. And so they wanted my sister and I to just have a great life at whatever cost. So it was kind of like, do what makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
There needs to be some boundaries.
Yeah,
and there
some guardrails. Yeah.
Right, and there wasn't. And so the military was perfect. It put a boot in my ass, taught me camaraderie, respect, hard work, teamwork. Things that I needed to learn, and it set me up for success for life. So for that, I'll always be thankful. If I could do it all back over again, I would do it again. It's the best decision I ever made was joining the military.
What were once you got in, what did you set new goals about where you wanted to end up in the military?
Like, yeah.
And what were those?
I wanted to get out as a staff sergeant, which I did.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's, I didn't fully earn it. It was more of like I was retiring and they, I said I wanted to be a staff sergeant. I was a sergeant. Mm-hmm. The next step up was staff sergeant. So they promoted me. So slightly fraudulent, but I'm honest about it. But I wanted to get out after Kosovo because I wasn't moving up as quick as I want. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to college, and college gives you promotion points. So it's just kind of stagnant on the list.
Right.
So I was like, well, this isn't going anywhere. And right. then the Iraq deployment came up. And I said, I'm going. And I took a move to a different unit so I could get promoted. And so then once I did that, I fell back in love with the Army. And I wanted to keep moving up. Eventually, you know, I didn't think I'd ever be a first sergeant or a sergeant major.
Mm-hmm.
But a platoon sergeant maybe would have been great. And then I kind of settled on staff sergeant to be a squad leader. And so that's what I got out as. No, my friend... my other team leader
yeah.
in my squad, he's now a sergeant major in the Minnesota National Guard.
Mm.
So he kept the dream alive and kept going, and he's doing great now. But yeah.
So you, when you're in the Middle East, the things that we see, and I feel like, you know, I feel like our media, I'd like to think they do a really good job of covering and showing you the realities. When you look back at that time, do they do a good job of showing us as the public kind of what life is like over there and what actually happens over there? Or is it sort of sensationalized or maybe not sensationalized and sort of hidden?
I think it's all of the above. It tries to show it as accurately as possible. There's no way to really walk someone through it
mm-hmm.
without them being there physically. I do think, especially at that time, it was really anti-war. It turned anti-war quickly because a lot of people were coming home and with a flag-draped coffin.
Yeah.
And people, none of us liked that, obviously. And the war was getting really bloody. We were there right during the surge. That's why our unit got extended. My buddies make fun of me because I didn't stay for the extension. But there were people that went on patrol with us, media, and did a pretty good job. Mm-hmm. And I think they try. But there was, I feel like, an agenda. Because if you don't like war and you go there, I think that can kind of bleed through into the way it's
sure.
portrayed.
Yeah.
And it in all of the media coverage, I do vividly remember, because I would go on there. I know you're not supposed to go on and look at what's in the news and whatnot. You focus on your job and that's it. But I would be disheartened. I mean, it hurt my heart at times to see that there wasn't support back here. And it wasn't anti-military, anti-soldiers. It was anti-war, which I get.
Mm-hmm.
Especially at my age now, but it was frustrating because we're over there doing a good job, and we made a hell of a difference. We went from it being one of the most dangerous areas in Iraq to being where our guys found a torture house after I was there. They got rid of the insurgents. There were 13 Al-Qaeda in Iraq insurgents that were running it. They would go around and kidnap locals that either cooperated with us
mm-hmm.
or didn't cooperate with the insurgents. They'd kidnap them, torture them for 3-4 days, behead them, leave them beheaded and bound with their hands behind their back right next to the village. Then the village would see that. They didn't want to talk to us. I wouldn't want to either.
Oh.
That was the way that they owned that area with fear, and it was the same cell that put the bomb in the road that got us. And our guys got them in I believe it was early January of 2007.
They did get them.
They got them, and they brought those 13 people to justice. They went through a trial.
Oh, they did?
The whole deal. Yep. Pretty sure they're no longer walking this planet, but they went through it the right way instead of taking vengeance out. And those are the stories that I wanted people to see. And it was in Minnesota because that story was broadcast here, and that was a big news story back then.
Mm-hmm.
But seeing that and seeing the people, you go on these patrols and you see these kids, and it was frustrating to hear people be like, what a waste, we shouldn't be over there. This little kid that I'm looking at, they deserve a chance at freedom like we have here, like our kids have. We're so lucky. And why wouldn't we want to give that to the rest of the world?
Right.
And it's tough because it costs lives.
Yeah.
And that's the way it's always been. But that was disheartening, knowing we'd go on a good patrol and be like, man, we did awesome today. We made people smile. We made the area safer. And then you come back and the top news story is what a waste it is, and that we shouldn't be here. We need to withdraw. And that did affect us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd imagine it would, because you know, you feel like within your group of guys that hey, we're doing the right thing. And we are making a difference. But then they'd be hard knowing that millions of people back home may look at you sideways and be like, what are you doing? Mm-hmm. Like, why are you supporting this? And you shouldn't be over there. I mean, much like the guys in the Vietnam War, yep. I can't imagine going through a wartime situation, fearful of your life, watching your buddies die in front of you, going on patrols where you don't know if you're going to make it back, only for the people that you live with in your country look at you like you're some sort of monster,
mm-hmm.
that you're just like this war-hungry monster that just wants to go over there and kill people or
right.
something, whatever the mindset is. I can't imagine that that detachment, emotional detachment. Let me ask, because you were in the House of Representatives, you're state rep, you are politically driven, civic driven, not just with your time in the military, but also when it comes to politics. When you look at our role in with our U.S. military in the Middle East, it doesn't have to be the Middle East, it can be Africa, it can be any of these other places that that are facing either war, militias, dictatorships, different forms of government. Let me phrase this in a way that when you saw those kids and the women and the men that are affected over in the Middle East and Iraq that maybe don't believe in our political system, but yet you guys were freeing them of fear. I think that's where we tend to get focused on why is the Americans the world police trying to push democracy on people. And when I listen to you talk, it's less about democracy and a political agenda, and it's more about freeing the human rights elements of like these people, whether they live in a dictatorship, a monarchy, or whatever, just don't have your people live in fear.
Right.
And give them an opportunity to live a life. And that's kind of what you saw with your own eyes, is that, you know, we're here to do a job to take out a bad guy and some bad insurgents, and maybe not push democracy, but we're trying to rid people of fear.
Right.
And that's an important component to keep in mind.
It is, and it's something we don't understand here. The fact that we can go to the polling place and vote and not tell anyone, and it's fine. That's our right. We're so used to it, we don't even think about it. Over there, there are people getting blown up, standing in line to vote, but they still voted. And those are heroes because they cared about the future of their country. And that's the thing about it. People can debate the reasons why we're there. President Bush got ripped on a lot for going. I've met the man. He described to us at the White House, to a bunch of wounded veterans, explained that he wouldn't have sent us there if it wasn't necessary. And you can see it in his eyes. He was affected by seeing us injured, mm-hmm. and he cared deeply about us. And so instead of debating all of this stuff, we all make mistakes. I hope our country learned from Iraq. And now in the future, if we have to do something similar, maybe we go about it a little different. But sometimes force is needed, and force was needed there. And I saw that in the setting up of the other government. That's the problem, is they have to want to set up a government and they have to go through the actions. Otherwise, we pull out like we did. ISIS moves in. Then those people are back in fear, maybe worse. And then we are the bad guy. They look mm-hmm. at us and say, why'd you do that? Because they were under fear of Saddam. But if they just kind of mind their own P's and Q's, they were probably going to be fine.
Right.
But they didn't have freedom, per se. It was always in fear, like you said. And that's the problem about it, is there's no right way of doing it. Hindsight is always 20/20. So I supported us being there. And again, I would go and do it again. We made a hell of a difference. Once that torture house was gone, mm-hmm. those locals were killing insurgents themselves if they saw them. And our company commander had to say, listen, you got to join the Iraqi army and let's work together. You can't just go Charles Bronson, Death Wish, and just start shooting people. But they cared about their country. They weren't afraid anymore, and they were willing to fight and shed their own blood for it. And that's how a country starts.
How do you look at other situations outside Iraq that the U.S. military kind of gets involved with? Do you have that perspective of looking back and looking at it from a different lens of like, okay, well, what's the real reason we're going in there? And maybe it's not for what the media is pushing out there. Did your experience sort of give you a whole nother outlook of just what the difference American soldiers can make and the American political system can make outside of changing their government, but just going in there to intervene. Like, is there are we doing a better job of, like, maybe we shouldn't go in there with guns blazing and have more of a a softer approach, a diplomatic approach? Like, is there have we learned our lessons from the from that war, or are we still kind of doing it the same way?
I think so. I mean, that's one great thing about our military. It's been around many years, and it continues to always improve. And we learn from our mistakes. On the training level, after you do a training mission, at the end, you always do an after-action review. You sit down and you talk what went well, what went your things that went well, what needs to be improved, and that's you learn from it, you move on to the next thing. That's a foundation of our military, all branches. So when there's a war, there's always an after-action review for that as well. And now I think there's a lot of war fatigue because we've been in Afghanistan forever. Mm-hmm. And so I get it. What I don't want is for there to be a threat and for our public to not support us intervening when it's necessary, whether it's for our best interest, an interest of an ally, or for the free world. Mm-hmm. That's important. And now that there's a big, not a fear of war, but the fatigue of it, special operations missions continue to go up. I mean, those are always going on. You go in, stuff we'll never see on the news, but good people are getting rid of bad people and helping the world.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine everything's going smaller, right? I think if we learned anything for the way that we've been attacked, we can't expect to go into a place, a country with 50,000 troops and just say, hey, we're here, because guess what? They might have a small militia of highly trained 10 to 15 guys that can really do some damage. And we're learning that we can do the same thing.
Absolutely. You know,
we can, that's why we have our SEAL teams. That's why we have our covert operations. So I'm grateful that we have that part of our military that can go out there and now save a lot of lives, because we're not going out there with a huge front of guys and we're not putting on display in armored vehicles and going down roads anymore. Like, we'll go through the cover of darkness and we're going to go silently and we're going to make our difference and we're going to get the hell out of there.
That's right. There was the one a couple weeks ago that there was an American citizen that had been kidnapped and was being helped. SEAL team went in, got rid of those guys, brought that person out. No big deal. That's it. It was a small news story, and that's awesome. And it's a testament to how amazing and versatile our military is. If we needed to go and gather up a huge army and invade like it's the Middle Ages, we can do it. If we need to go in with a small, agile force, we can do that now too. Our military it's fantastic.
Do you think you'd have the same perspective on life here in the United States if you, let's say you go through your deployment, the bomb doesn't go off, but you're still seeing life over there? Do you think that you would have the same perspective as you do now?
I think I would have the same perspective on our country and how lucky we are to live here. On life, I wouldn't, obviously.
Right.
That changed my outlook there. But even my deployment to Kosovo in 2004, at 22, that was my first time in a third world country, not including spring break and some places. But
you're kind of Tijuana.
the foam party in Cancun, I'm not counting that as a third world experience. But I saw that, and firsthand, I was like, holy shit. Because, you know, our parents and our teachers and stuff, they'll teach us about the world. But when you go experience it, that's when you really understand. And I thought, my goodness, we are so lucky.
Yeah. Would you recommend that advice to not for military purposes, but for young kids to go explore the world for that reason?
Absolutely. Peace Corps or whatever else, go on a mission to help other, or because there some of the places that are tough that I think you learn the most are not places you can go on Expedia and book a trip for or something. But to be a part of something like that, yeah, if military's not your thing, go and see those places and help them get out of the funk that they're in. But also, you'll gain perspective and come back here and go, we can complain about the cold weather. We can complain about this and that, or whether our Wi-Fi is not working or whatnot.
Yeah.
We've got it made. So many people would kill to have the problems we have here.
Does your wife get annoyed with your perspective like that, though?
Yes. Big time. Oh yeah.
Because I would imagine that that would be a little exhausting too, because we have life complaints. We have daily complaints of like just like the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
Goddamn Wi-Fi, it's so damn slow. And if you turn around and be like, it's this Wi-Fi. It's not that big a deal. She'd be like, well, shut. Like, can I have a complaint in life?
Right. Like, I try not to be. Oh, like that, because that would get annoying. She'll be like, can I have a fucking bad day? And I'm like, yeah. Yes, dear. Yes. Because I don't ever, in the way I share my story, I don't want people to be like, I got laid off from my job and my wife's banging the whole office. I'm getting a divorce and whatever. She's taking the family and leaving me. But at least I got my legs. No,
it's
not about that. It's more of just a perspective that we all have adversity in our life, whether it's Wi-Fi going down, whether you lose your job, whether your restaurant that you just opened is now shut down for good because of COVID. Mm-hmm. That doesn't matter. It's the attitude you bring to the table, and you'll get through it, and life is going to be fine. I broke my iPhone last week. I got the brand new iPhone, and I dropped it on my wheelchair that I told you, the footrest that flips up. Second phone that's happened to, and it broke, and I was pissed off about it. For probably an hour or so, I was annoyed. Life goes on. But she does get a little bit exhausted over it.
I would too. which is totally natural. Well, we're probably just coming to the end of this discussion. I know because of COVID, all of your public speaking is probably gone virtual
and
different things, but please, this is your time, at least on this podcast, to like get your website out and talk about what a company is going to find when you come and speak to them, either virtually or in person.
Sure. So the way I share my story, similar to how I did on here, I use humor throughout to make sure that it's not, of course, it's a heavy emotional story, but I make sure that there's humor injected throughout to make sure that it's not something that's going to ruin your day. You'll walk away uplifted, you'll feel inspired, and you'll have a new outlook on life, a new outlook on your career, and it's a fun 45 minutes, I assure you that. And so I enjoy doing it. Like I said, there's times I wake up and I can't believe this all happened to me. And I can't believe how good my life is now. Mm-hmm. I never would have thought it would have turned out like this. So I'm thankful for that. And I am thankful that I get to share the lessons I've learned without people having to go through what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that is the greatest blessing I've had. And it feels so good every day to see that I can impact other people in a positive way. So whether it's during COVID, we have to do it virtually, or whether it's in person, because I have some in-person ones booked in the spring, johnmkreisel.com, and it's K-R-I-E-S-E-L.com. That's where you can get my speaking information. You can see video clips of what I have to share. My book is also available.
Yep.
Still standing.
Yep. Thank you for the book. Like I said, I had the original.
Yes.
And so I'm glad I have the...
This one's updated and better.
Yeah. Updated. Look at how skinny you are.
I know. I was... Basically, my full meal, Ben, when I was in the hospital, was pills. They'd bring the pills in. My stomach was so full of those. I had no... And the pills themselves affected appetite. I mean, a good 15-mile-an-hour wind gust, and I might have been gone.
What did you weigh here?
Without prosthetics, probably 95 pounds.
Whoa.
Yeah, just a small fella. And so, beer, home cooking... I'm back to fight and weight.
Wow. And how much I was going to ask that when we were talking about just like your daily life stuff, like the bathroom habits and like how that even affects you. But like, you like to have fun, and you talk about like you'll go out and rip it up and have fun. How much less do you have to drink now because of your overall body weight, your body
more.
Mass? What do you mean more?
I think my tolerance is up. And I don't really get after it during the week. It's mostly a weekend thing.
Yeah.
But if I really put my mind, I can throw them back. Yeah. Now, for a while, yes. Before I started tying one on more, yes. Because when I was on that medication and stuff, like one cocktail and you wouldn't want to mix those things. And then I weaned myself off of all that garbage. And then I'd have a couple cocktails. And for a while... It didn't take me a lot. I was a cheap date. But now, man, that bill can get expensive. So I drink at home.
So is your body in any way affected? Like you talked about your arm and your intestines and all that stuff. So are you internally, are you sort of back to normal?
Not really. I mean, with the intestines specifically, because they took a portion of my, I think it was my small colon. So it goes from a 4-lane highway to a 2-lane highway.
Okay.
So I got to make sure that I have good supplements to make sure.
So you
that,
still, you have to supplement your,
yeah,
your body.
I take vitamins. But yeah, I don't want to, if I don't drink a lot of water, if I, it's like Vegas, I got to make sure to do Pedialyte or water or something if I'm drinking all day, because otherwise
it just gets gummed up.
You get backed up. Oh yeah. And that's not fun.
You have to like make sure you like over chew your food and stuff like that.
No.
Or no,
nope.
So that part hasn't changed. Just make sure that you're properly hydrated.
That's right.
You can get a little gummy down.
Otherwise
there.
The jumper's at the door and he can't get out of the plane.
Got a hell of a turtle head sticking out, man. Like somebody needs to push that thing through. And your arm's fine?
Yeah. Yep. And the break, because I broke it golfing this year.
That's right.
Because I've got rods in this arm and there is a spot that I must have hit it on something, because golf I don't think did it.
Yeah.
But my arm hurt for a long time. But I was golfing the best I ever had because I wasn't swinging my ass off. I was just nice and easy.
Right.
And so I was like, I like that my arm hurts. I'm just going to keep golfing this way. And of course, then it kept getting worse and finally cleaned through. And so that's mostly healed now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So about a month or so, I can start swinging the clubs again. But yeah, I'm mostly good. Like I don't have, like Tim gets headaches and he's got back problems and stuff. They had to piece my pelvis and stuff back together.
Yeah.
But that hardware got taken out. And so I feel pretty damn good. I'll have aches and pains and stuff, but.
Yeah.
But it's not bad.
And where your legs attached to your prosthetics, do those get sore?
They get sore a bit, but it's not. It's more of like a tiredness. Like I would remember on a long day, if you're on your feet all day and you take your shoes off, it's kind of like that relief to take the prosthetics off.
Right.
So it's like that.
But it's not painful. It's not like you get shooting pains and stuff like that.
I get some phantom pain here and there. Yeah. And it's manageable as long as it's not 3 a.m. Because then you're like, holy shit, I want to go back to sleep. And it feels like someone's taking a knife and just slicing your skin.
Ugh.
That's annoying, yeah, for sure. So that part sucks, but it's a handful of times a year. In the grand scheme of things, man, I'm a lucky guy.
What do you do for exercise?
Nothing lately. I need to get into exercise again, though, because I want to live a long time.
Yeah.
So when I do exercise, it will be like crunches. I'll walk on the treadmill, and so we've got the Peloton. So I'll do the Las Vegas Strip. Now it moves much quicker on the screen, like I'm running.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I'm just taking a nice walk.
What about upper body stuff? Do you have like the arm cycle things?
I have a hand cycle.
Yes. Hand cycle.
And now I'll probably get a hand bicycle to go out on bike rides when Chloe's a little older. So
we got to get you in the boxing gym, man.
I'd love it. I would do that for sure.
Because that's. The reason I took up boxing is because my lower body hurt doing everything else. Like I tried doing the CrossFit stuff.
Because you've had surgeries.
Huh? Just a couple, but like I'm bone on bone in my left knee, and that was the biggest thing. Is like you do these other CrossFit things or whatever, and like the bounding, you know, the jumping, the explosive movements and stuff. You're just doing box jumps and all that, and it would just wear on my knee and just keep me up at night because you get that throbbing pain. But boxing's great because there's no real major impact. It's an upper body torque. And because of your situation, yeah, you'd like to like kind of throw your, like turn your toes a little bit as you like kind of pivot your feet a little bit as you throw. But like, dude, you can still get a great workout just standing there and just rotating your hips. I mean, you watch these boxers spar and do all this stuff on the heavy bag. They're not over rotating their lower body so much. But I'm telling you, man, your upper body workout, and plus at the end of the workout, they do all these ab exercises. You're smoked, and you're sweating your face off. So whenever we get back into the actual gym, we should, because Hockey's took it up, but he took it up as well.
All right,
and he loves it. So we should all get together and do that, because it is an awesome workout.
I'd love it. Yeah, that was one of I loved about the military. We work out every day, and that was a good feeling. I was in my best shape of my life. And so I need to get back to that. I do okay, but I can do better.
Yeah, Yeah. Well, listen, dude, I know that you've got a full day, and because of this is your live day, and it just happens that we're doing this podcast, I can't thank you enough for using this hour and change to sit down with us and tell your story. Thinking about you today, appreciate you as always. Love you, brother.
I love you.
I think that's the one thing that we don't say enough, and I've learned from you. Believe it or not, I mean, obviously you've inspired a lot of us to do different things, but we as men don't say I love you very often to other men outside of your family. And that is something that you do all the time.
Because you never know. You never know.
Yeah.
And so it's important to say that because you never want to look back and say, I wish I said this.
Yes.
And you are one of my favorite people on the planet.
Thank you.
You're a great guy. And so it meant a lot that you asked me to be on this. So yeah. I was very excited to be a part of it, and I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah. Yeah, buddy, you're the best. You're the best. Thank you. And I hope you guys all enjoyed this. Please subscribe to this podcast, Unrestricted, iHeart, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and tell your friends, tell your families. I say go to the highest mountaintop and scream it to everybody. This is one of the more important and inspirational podcasts I've done. I got to thank John for it, and I'll thank Dave Yeager for putting all this together. He's my sound guy. And I want to thank Pick and Shovel Wear Apparel as well, Wexford Harbor Insurance, and certainly Douglas and Todd, in which, John, you've got a bottle of Douglas and Todd, and we've got some Wexford Harbor lowball glasses in that little black box right there for you as well. So enjoy.
Thank you.
Enjoy on your live day, hopefully a few fingers of Douglas and Todd bourbon. And that'll do it for all of us, and thanks for listening. Bye.